A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of problem that hits you about 3 days after you've unpacked the last box. You move into a New Jerusalem apartment, you're feeling good about it, and then you discover a pigeon fortress blocking your safe room's protective shutter, plus a second colony setting up camp on the front balcony. Summer is peak breeding season, the windows are open, and suddenly you're living next door to a bird metropolis you didn't sign a lease with. Daniel's asking the practical questions. Who do you call for cleanup? What are the actual health risks? And how do you install netting on a rental balcony without losing your deposit?
This is one of those problems where the gap between what you think you can handle and what you should actually handle is dangerously wide. I've seen people go at dried droppings with a broom and a dustpan, and that is genuinely one of the worst things you can do.
Where do we start with this? Because Daniel's got two separate problems here. The blocked shutter track that needs professional cleanup, and the front balcony that needs netting once the chicks have fledged.
Let's frame it exactly that way. This is a two-part problem. Part one is remediation, dealing with what's already there, the nests, the droppings, the health hazards. Part two is exclusion, preventing future pigeons from moving back in. And the whole thing is filtered through the renter's constraint. Everything has to be reversible, landlord-approved, and not leave permanent marks.
Which is the tension, right? You want professional-grade results, but you can't drill into someone else's concrete. So the first question is the most urgent. Who do you call when you've got a pigeon fortress blocking your safe room, and what do they actually do?
You want a specialist bird control company. In Israel, they're typically listed under Hadarat Yonam. That's the search term. These are companies that combine pest control knowledge with the physical work of removal and exclusion. A general pest control company might take the call, but they often subcontract the actual removal work, or they lack the equipment for high-rise access. You want the people who do this every day.
What makes this specialist different in practice?
A general exterminator is trained to apply chemicals for insects and rodents. Bird work is different. It's physical removal, working at height, and biohazard handling. A bird control specialist arrives with scaffolding or a cherry picker if needed, full PPE, HEPA vacuums, and enzyme-based disinfectants. They're also the ones who can assess whether the birds have mites, whether the nesting site is structural, and what exclusion method will actually work for that specific balcony geometry.
It's not just pest control plus a ladder.
It's really not. And the cost in Israel for a single balcony or shutter track cleanup typically runs between 400 and 800 shekels, depending on severity and height. If you're on the fifth floor and they need a lift, that pushes toward the upper end.
Daniel mentioned the shutter track specifically. That's a confined space, probably caked with old material. Walk me through what the professional visit actually looks like.
This is where it gets methodical. A proper visit has about 5 stages. First, they do an initial assessment and photo documentation. Partly for their own records, partly so you can show the landlord what was done. Second, they manually remove the nests and droppings. This is not scraping with a putty knife. They use HEPA vacuum scraping tools, and critically, they wet everything down first before disturbing it.
Why is the wetting step so important?
Because dried pigeon droppings aerosolize when you disturb them. You create a cloud of dust that contains fungal spores, and you inhale that. The wetting suppresses the dust. It's the single most important safety step in the whole process, and it's the thing a DIY job almost always skips.
Which brings us to the health question. What's actually in that dust?
2 main fungal pathogens, Histoplasma capsulatum and Cryptococcus neoformans. Histoplasma is a dimorphic fungus. It grows as a mold in soil enriched with bird or bat droppings, but when you inhale the spores, it converts to a yeast form in your lungs and can disseminate. Symptoms appear 3 to 17 days after exposure. Fever, cough, fatigue. And in chronic cases, it can look like tuberculosis, with lung cavities and everything.
The second one?
Cryptococcus is the one that keeps me up at night, and I say that as a retired pediatrician. It primarily causes problems in immunocompromised people, and the scary complication is cryptococcal meningitis. The fungus crosses the blood-brain barrier. Treatment requires months of intravenous antifungals. It's not common, but it's catastrophic when it happens, and the exposure route is exactly this: inhaling dried droppings dust.
When someone says, "I'll just sweep it up with a dustpan," they're essentially rolling the dice on a fungal lung infection.
They are, and the dice are worse than most people realize. There was a documented histoplasma outbreak a few years ago traced to a school renovation where dry droppings were swept without PPE, 14 people hospitalized. The cleanup crew assumed it was just bird mess and treated it like ordinary construction dust. That's the misconception that gets people hurt.
What about bleach? People reach for bleach when they see biological mess.
That's actually another misconception worth busting. Bleach can aerosolize spores more aggressively. The chemical reaction with organic matter creates off-gassing that kicks particles into the air. What professionals use are enzyme-based disinfectants, something like Virusol or equivalent products designed to break down organic matter and kill fungal spores at the same time. The enzyme action digests the proteins in the droppings rather than just oxidizing the surface.
The professional protocol: they wet it, scrape it with HEPA filtration, apply enzyme cleaner, and then what?
After disinfection, they may install temporary exclusion mesh or spikes if needed, then do a final disinfection pass, and all waste gets sealed in biohazard bags for disposal. The crew is wearing full Tyvek suits, P100 respirators, and eye protection the entire time. P100 is the key spec. It filters 99.97% of airborne particles, including fungal spores. An N95 mask is not sufficient for this work.
Daniel's shutter track problem. That's an enclosed space where spores have nowhere to go. Even worse than an open balcony.
The track is a channel that concentrates the droppings and limits airflow. When you start scraping in there, you're working inside a spore cloud. That's a textbook case for professional remediation. I would not touch that myself, even with PPE, because the confined geometry makes it hard to control dust direction.
One thing I've noticed, and I mentioned this in passing once, is that pigeon mites can migrate from nests into apartments through gaps. You get these tiny mites coming through window sills, and suddenly you've got itchy welts and a secondary infestation inside the home.
Bird mites don't survive long on human blood, but they'll bite you repeatedly while they're trying. And they're nearly invisible. People go to dermatologists thinking they have an allergic reaction, and it takes a while to trace it back to the pigeon nest outside the window. Another reason not to let nests sit.
For Daniel Shuttertrack, the answer is clear. Call a Hadarat Yonim specialist. Spend the 400 to 800 shekels. Let them handle the biohazard. But once the existing mess is cleaned up, the real question is how to keep it from happening again. And that's where netting comes in.
This is the part where the renter's constraint really bites. Daniel's apartment already has netting on one balcony, so he knows it works. The question is whether he can install it himself on the front balcony without drilling into the building.
Let's talk about the balcony itself. A standard Israeli balcony is what? About 1.2 to 1.5 meters deep, 2 to 3 meters wide.
That's typical for a Jerusalem apartment. Maybe a concrete parapet, maybe a railing. The geometry matters enormously for how hard the netting job is going to be.
What's the right material?
UV-stabilized polyethylene mesh, 19mm square openings, 2mm thickness. That's the standard for pigeon exclusion. 19mm is small enough that pigeons can't push through, but large enough that it doesn't create a sail effect in the wind. If you're also dealing with sparrows, you'd go down to 10mm openings, but for pigeons alone, 19 is the sweet spot.
Where do you get this in Israel?
Ace, Home Center, or specialized suppliers like Netta or Barmore. The specialized suppliers will also sell you the stainless steel or UV-resistant zip ties, grommets, and mounting hardware. You want stainless steel zip ties if you're near the coast where salt corrosion is an issue, but in Jerusalem, UV-resistant nylon ties are fine.
Walk me through the actual installation. I've got my mesh, my zip ties, my mounting hardware. What's step one?
Measure the perimeter of the opening you're covering. Cut the mesh with about 10 centimeters of overhang on each side. You want excess, not a tight fit, because you need material to tension. Then you attach at roughly 30 centimeter intervals using zip ties through grommets or directly through the mesh. The critical detail that separates a working installation from a pigeon party is tension. The mesh must be pulled taut. Sagging creates pockets where pigeons can perch, and a perching pigeon will eventually find a way through or around.
A sagging net is basically a pigeon hammock.
That is the most horrifyingly accurate description I've heard, a pigeon hammock. And once one pigeon figures out the hammock, the whole colony moves in.
Tension is everything. But here's the renter's question. How do you attach the mesh to the balcony structure without drilling?
There are two approaches that work. Option one is heavy-duty command outdoor hooks, the ones rated for 4 kilograms each. They adhere to painted concrete or metal surfaces, and when you move out, you pull the tab and they release clean. For a standard balcony netting job, you'd place these at 30-centimeter intervals along the top edge of the opening, zip-tie the mesh to the hooks, and do the same along the sides and bottom.
4 kilograms per hook. Sounds like a lot for a plastic sticker.
It's a legitimate rating when they're applied correctly. Clean, dry surface, pressed firmly for 30 seconds, left to cure for an hour before loading. The failure mode is usually poor surface prep, not the adhesive itself. If the concrete is dusty or flaking, the hook won't bond properly.
What's option two?
Spring tension curtain rods mounted inside the balcony frame. This works if you have a rectangular opening with parallel surfaces. You mount the rod horizontally across the top, attach the mesh to it, tension it downward, and secure the bottom with another rod or with command hooks. The rods press against the sides with spring force. No adhesive, no drilling, completely reversible in 30 seconds.
For the sides? You can't tension a curtain rod vertically.
For the sides, you'd use command hooks, or if the balcony has mortar joints between tiles or bricks, you can use clamp brackets that grip into the mortar joint without penetrating. Those leave a tiny indentation in the mortar that's easily filled with a dab of filler when you move out. Invisible repair, landlord won't even notice.
What about aluminum channel track with sliding clips? I've seen that on some balconies.
That's a more semi-permanent option. You screw a thin aluminum track into the mortar joints, not into the brick or tile itself, and then sliding clips attach the mesh to the track. The advantage is that you can slide the mesh open and closed like a curtain, which is useful if you need access to the outside of the balcony for cleaning or maintenance. When you move out, you unscrew the track and fill the tiny holes in the mortar. It's more work to install and remove, but it looks cleaner and lasts longer.
We've got a spectrum from fully temporary to semi-permanent. Now, when does this cross the line from, I can do this Saturday morning to, I need to write a check?
There are 4 clear triggers for calling a professional. First, any balcony above the 3rd floor where you'd need to lean out to attach mesh. If you're reaching over a railing with a zip tie in one hand and nothing but air below you, that's a fall risk. Professionals have harnesses and anchors.
The second trigger?
Irregular shapes or obstructions. A straight rectangular balcony with a concrete parapet is a 30-minute DIY job. A curved balcony with a wrought iron railing, pipes, and an AC condenser unit in the corner. That's a pro-only nightmare. You're cutting custom mesh panels, working around obstacles, and the attachment points are all non-standard. Jerusalem has historic districts. Nachlaut, the German colony, parts of the old city basin, where visible netting may be restricted or need to be a specific color. Black mesh is standard and least visible, but some committees require beige or gray to match the stone. If your building has a Va'ad Bayit, a building committee, you need their approval before installing anything visible from the street.
Daniel's in a rental, so he's got both a landlord and potentially a building committee to satisfy.
Which brings us to the 4th trigger, if the landlord requires a certified installer for insurance reasons. Some landlords are fine with the tenant doing clean, reversible work. Others want a receipt from a licensed company. Daniel needs to have that conversation before buying mesh.
There's also a timing consideration here that Daniel mentioned. The chicks. You can't just install netting whenever you notice the problem.
Pigeon chicks fledge about 25 to 32 days after hatching. If you install netting before they fledge, one of two things happens. Either you trap the chicks inside the netting, which is inhumane and they'll die and rot, or you separate the parents from the nest and the chicks starve. Either way, you've created a bigger problem than you started with. You have to wait until the nest is empty.
How do you know when the chicks have fledged?
Pigeon chicks are in the nest for about 4 weeks. When you stop seeing adult birds making frequent feeding trips and you don't hear cheeping from the nest, they probably left. Give it a few extra days to be sure, then move fast, because pigeons are site faithful, and the adults will start a new clutch almost immediately if the site is still available.
That's the misconception, right? People think if you remove the nest, the pigeons leave forever. But they're site faithful. Without exclusion, they rebuild within days.
Sometimes the same day. I've heard of people removing a nest in the morning and finding new twigs by evening. Pigeons don't get the hint. You have to physically exclude them.
The sequence is, wait for fledging, remove the nest and clean, install exclusion netting immediately. If you leave a gap between cleanup and netting, you're racing the pigeons.
They're faster than you. They have nothing else to do.
Let's say Daniel's balcony is a straightforward rectangle with a concrete parapet, second floor, no historic district restrictions. He's got landlord approval for removable netting. He's waited for the chicks to fledge. He's buying materials this week. What's his shopping list?
UV-stabilized 19mm polyethylene mesh, measure the opening and add 20cm to each dimension for overhang, a pack of stainless steel or UV-resistant zip ties. If the mesh doesn't come with grommets, buy a grommet kit and install them at 30cm intervals along the edges. A pack of heavy-duty Command outdoor hooks, scissors or utility knife for cutting the mesh, and a tape measure, obviously. Clean the mounting surfaces thoroughly. Dust is the enemy of adhesive hooks. Mark your hook positions at 30cm intervals. Apply the hooks, press firmly, wait the recommended cure time, cut the mesh to size with overhang. Start at the top center, zip tie the mesh to the top hooks, and work outward to the corners. Then pull downward, tensioning as you go, and secure the sides and bottom. The goal is drum tight. If you can push the mesh inward more than a few centimeters, it's too loose. Check monthly for sagging, especially after strong winds or heavy rain. Zip ties can loosen, hooks can shift. If a pigeon lands on the mesh and it holds their weight without sagging, it's properly tensioned. If it dips, retension.
One thing I'd add. Document everything. Take before photos of the droppings in the nest, during photos of the cleanup if you hire a pro, and after photos of the netting installation. If there's ever a dispute with the landlord about damage or deposits, you want a paper trail.
Get written approval, not a verbal, sure, go ahead, from the landlord. An email or a WhatsApp message that you can screenshot. It protects your deposit and avoids the, I never said you could do that, conversation 6 months later.
We've covered the cleanup and the prevention. Let's boil this down to a concrete plan someone can execute this week.
Step 1. Call a specialist bird control company for the shutter track cleanup. Do not DIY this. The confined space, the dry droppings, the spore risk, it's not worth it. Spend the 400 to 800 shekels.
Step 2. Wait for the chicks to fledge. Watch the nest. Confirm they're gone. Then move immediately.
Step 3. Measure your balcony and order the materials. 19mm UV-stabilized mesh, zip ties, Command outdoor hooks. If your balcony is a simple rectangle and you can reach every attachment point while standing safely on the floor, DIY is reasonable.
Step 4. Install the mesh taut with 30cm zip tie spacing. Check monthly for sagging. If you can lean over the railing to reach an attachment point, or if you need a ladder, or if the balcony is above the third floor, stop and hire a pro.
Step 5. Document everything. Before and after photos, written landlord approval. This is your deposit protection.
The key decision rule is almost comically simple. If you can reach every attachment point while standing safely on the balcony floor, DIY. If you need to lean out, climb, or balance on anything, hire a pro.
That rule alone would prevent most of the balcony injuries I've heard about. People don't fall from standing safely on their own floor. They fall when they lean out with a drill in one hand and suddenly their center of gravity shifts.
That's the practical playbook. But stepping back, this pigeon problem raises a bigger question about how we design urban spaces.
I've been thinking about that too. Pigeon populations in the Tel Aviv to Jerusalem corridor have grown something like 20% over the past 5 years. That's not a small increase. Every new building that goes up without bird-proofing creates more nesting surfaces. Every balcony left uncovered becomes a colony site that produces more pigeons that look for more balconies.
It's a feedback loop. And the same exclusion techniques we've been talking about for balconies are increasingly being applied to solar panel arrays and AC condenser units. Pigeons love the warmth and shelter under solar panels. This trade is only going to grow.
Which makes me wonder. At what point do building codes start mandating bird-proofing in new construction? If you know that a flat surface above a certain height will attract pigeons, and you know that pigeon infestations create health hazards, is there a regulatory argument for requiring exclusion mesh at the design stage rather than retrofitting it later?
Retrofitting is always more expensive than building it in. A few hundred shekels of mesh during construction versus thousands later.
The health system cost. Every histoplasmosis case that could have been prevented, every cryptococcal meningitis patient spending months on antifungals, that's a public health externality that the building code doesn't currently price in.
Something to watch. In the meantime, Daniel's got a shutter track to clean and a balcony to net.
Now he knows exactly what to do.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1817, the lighthouse keeper at the Mahica River Station, in what is now Guyana, recorded that his lamp consumed 1.5 gallons of spermaceti oil per night during the rainy season. Modern equivalent, that's roughly the energy output of a single LED nightlight running for 6 months.
Right. If you've got a weird prompt of your own, pigeon-related or otherwise, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.